The scripture reading is from Psalm 119, not verse 7, but verse 17 to 24. Deal bountifully with your servant, so that I may live and observe your word. Open my eyes, so that I may behold wondrous things out of your law. I live as an alien in the land. Do not hide your commandments from me. My soul is consumed with longing for your ordinances at all times. You rebuke the insolent, accursed ones who wander from your commandments. Take away from me their scorn and contempt, for I keep your decrees. Even though princes sit plotting against me, your servant will meditate on your statutes. Your decrees are my delight. They are my counselors.
Thank you for that reading, Doreen. So we are spending a little more time in Psalm 119. I don't know if this is a passage that's stuck out to you over the years, but it has for me a little bit, and there's a lot of little things, and I hope over this sermon series I get to address some of them. I'm pretty sure I would know if any of you had the Hebrew alphabet memorized. I don't think any of you do, and that's fine. It's not a requirement. But I wanted to sort of point out, if you're looking at Psalm 119, a lot of your Bibles will show the Hebrew characters. This is an acrostic poem. You know, a lot of times for Christmas, we will have children come up and they will say, M is for Mary, who said yes to the angel. E is for whatever. Like, this is an acrostic poem. The letters of the alphabet, of the Hebrew alphabet, guide this poem. And that's why there's so many verses in this chapter, because there are so many letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And so we all know our ABCs. Some of you will know Greek. I had to use Greek characters when I did math a lot of times, especially geometry. The angles were usually represented by Greek characters. And we use Greek characters all the time for other things. Somebody might say that they're an alpha wolf. If you're in computer gaming industry, you might have a beta tester. There are gamma rays in science. Almost probably half of the Greek letters would be familiar in some variety. But in Hebrew, it's a little bit less familiar, and yet they look sort of the same. So our English word alphabet comes from putting the two Greek letters, the first two Greek letters together, alpha, beta, sounds a lot like alphabet. And the first two Hebrew letters in the alphabet are aleph and bet. It's almost exactly the same sound. And I could go into the nuances of the Hebrew language a little bit more. I won't, and I'll explain. I was in university, I took Biblical New Testament Greek as one of my courses. I took a few semesters of that, and I did okay. I had a pretty good professor and paid attention, had some good friends around me. I took Biblical Hebrew as a class, and it didn't go quite as well, partly because I took it in exactly the same semester as I took Introduction to New Testament Greek. But I was familiar with the New Testament a lot more than I was with the Old Testament. And also, there weren't any Greek-speaking students in my New Testament class, but there were a whole bunch of Jewish students who spoke contemporary Hebrew in my Biblical Hebrew class. And so there was sort of this divide between those of us who were there for theological reasons and those of us who were there for cultural reasons, thinking they were going to get an easier mark. But when we study languages, this happens sometimes that we feel ourselves on the outside of what's happening. The Hebrew professor would make Hebrew jokes to the other Hebrew students, and I just sat there kind of blinking my eyes, trying to keep up and failing miserably, failing metaphorically. I did pass the class, but it was tough to feel that on the outside of that class dynamic. So then you can see sort of where we're at. This is the third character in the Hebrew alphabet. To be fair, I probably should have maybe right justified it. And you read Hebrew right to left. So I've accommodated for the ways that we read here. The idea behind this sermon series is that a psalm singing praises to God's laws sounds strange to us. For a couple of reasons, mostly good. We, within the Christian church, we understand that we've sort of gone beyond the law, beyond the Old Testament law. So we read the newer part of the Bible. We call it the New Testament. We would say that it also represents a new covenant, a new promise, even a new law. But at the same time, Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, which we as Mennonites love to read, the Sermon on the Mount, he says, "Don't even think that I have come to do away with the law and the prophets. I haven't come to do away with them, but to fulfill them." So if we have biblical reasons for loving the law and also not liking the law anymore. And we as human beings kind of don't like to be restricted. We don't like being told what to do. So then in that sense, we hate the law. But we really like it if other people behave the way that we want them to. And so we like the law when it applies to other people. So this is where we find ourselves reading the law. This is small enough, you don't have to look closely to read it. But what I've done again... And I've chosen colors poorly, I think. But what I've done is I've highlighted all of the words that mean some variation of law. Every verse makes reference to the law and how we can rely on the law and how the law strengthens us and how much the psalmist here loves the law. There are a couple of verses that stuck out to me. This is one of them in verse 19. It says, "I'm an immigrant in the land. Don't hide your commandments from me." Don't hide your commandments from me. Some of us, we have an immigrant experience in our family history. Some of us have been here so long we've entirely lost that experience. My parents were both born in Mexico. I was born in Canada, so I still have some of that memory, still the feeling of being an immigrant. Where I grew up, there were a whole bunch of Mennonite immigrants who spoke the same language, who wore more or less the same clothes, and it wasn't always a point of pride to identify with that community. And there were people within our community, the ones who had arrived more recently, they had a certain distrust of the law. They had a distrust of legal authorities for a couple of reasons. Because where they came from, in their part of Mexico, the legal authorities there weren't super reliable. They wouldn't come when they were called necessarily. And if they came, you could buy them off in a lot of the communities. So when people from that context came here, well, then they had no reason to believe that the legal authorities here were any more upright, were any more reliable, or were any more just. And then on top of that, most people, our interactions with police isn't positive, and we speak the language. So an immigrant comes here, They don't speak the language. They don't have the law book of the country committed to memory. And so here is an embodiment of the law, the legal standards of the country. They're coming to the vehicle to see what you're doing right. And they would enforce things that to immigrants would sometimes seem arbitrary. So there were people in our community who had big families. I have 9 siblings. I'm from a big family. And it's sometimes difficult to find a vehicle with enough working seat belts for everybody in the family. And a policeman often thinks that that's a requirement. So the policeman would come to the vehicle and explain to the driver, you need to have enough working seat belts for everybody in your vehicle. Well, why? I drive safely. I drive carefully. My wife is holding on very tightly to that baby. We're all safe. Right? And so in the eyes of the immigrant, this law is arbitrary and pointless. And the temperament of the policeman doesn't seem to back this up. Why is he being so grouchy? Well, the policeman is also worried about the language barrier. The policeman is also worried about how he's going to communicate the seriousness of the situation without embarrassing the father in front of the family, without being accused of racism or xenophobia. The policeman is concerned about a lot of things, and so there's tension in that conversation. And there are many stories from other communities, too, where the law does not seem to be on the side of the immigrant. So when we read these words in Psalm 119, verse 19, I'm an immigrant in the law. Don't hide your commandments from me. Right? In David's words, or in the words of the psalmist who's put this together, we hear this this mixed identity. Right? That I don't belong here. I don't understand the rules. I don't fit in with the culture. But I can't be on the outside of the law. I need the law to support me. I need the law to be on my side here. I am just as deserving of protection as an immigrant as somebody who's been here their whole lives. So we can make a metaphor of this very easily. If you can't identify with the immigrant experience, you can still get something out of this verse. Right? You know that when you don't have money, sometimes you are shooed out of places where people with more money get to stay. And you don't want to be an immigrant in that space in the sense that you don't have the money. When you're in a new neighborhood and you don't know where to go and you're a racial minority in that neighborhood, you don't want to be victimized just because of who you are. When you're surrounded by people who all have more education than you, or who all have different hobbies than you but the same as each other, then you get to feel like an immigrant in that space, and you don't want to be on the outside simply because you don't belong. You want people to include you. You don't want to be at risk because you are an outsider. And so these words from the psalmist help us to identify with that space. I'm an immigrant in the land. Don't hide your commandments from me. We have a few stories of immigrants in the Bible, and I went through these a little while ago. But this is one that jumps out to me. I'll just use these few verses here from Ruth chapter 2. So in the book of Ruth, I'll summarize this long story in just a minute. Ruth is not Jewish. She's not part of Israeli culture, Israeli religion. This is not her story. She grew up in Moab, but while she was there, she married a man who was a Jewish immigrant into Moab. Well, eventually her husband died, and her brother-in-law died, and her father-in-law died, leaving 3 widows. And so Ruth, the mother-in-law, said she was going to go back to Israel because she had nothing left, and that's where she needed to be. And there's sort of a recognition in this story that Ruth, as a widow, as an older woman, was already going to be dependent, and it was better for her to go back to her familiar land where the law would sort of protect her, than to stay in Moab, where she as an immigrant may be on the outside of the law in a lot of ways. So then Ruth, for some reason, perhaps no other reason than her virtue, her goodness, her righteousness, she decides she's going to go with Ruth. She's going to go with Naomi, her mother-in-law. So Ruth and Naomi, they travel together. They arrive there. They are both widows. They are both poor. They both need the charity of others. So what does Ruth do? Well, she goes to collect food. Well, what she's doing is relying on laws in the Jewish code that provided for immigrants, that provided for the poor. So around in those rules, you had to leave a strip of land on the outside of your field that you wouldn't harvest. There were crops growing there, but you wouldn't harvest it. You would leave it for the immigrants and the poor to come through and pick up their own. And these outsiders then would follow the regular workers and sort of pick up what they had dropped. It doesn't sound like a comfortable living, but this is the only thing that Ruth had for herself and her mother-in-law. Now, maybe Naomi had communicated, listen, in Israel there are legal provisions for immigrants that Moab doesn't have. Maybe that is, I haven't looked at the Moabite law code, but there was a legal code that provided for immigrants. And in this story, Ruth is explained to be the grandmother of David. So David is supposed to be this kind of pure Jewish identity figure, but he has a Moabite woman in his family tree. There is space for immigrants within the Jewish religious system because there was space for Ruth. Now, if we go back to the psalm, the other verse that jumped out to me from here, it says, "You rebuke the arrogant, accursed people who stray from your commandments." Doreen's passage said insolent. These powerful words that describe people who don't see themselves needing to stick to the law. Now, for this next part, I want you to sort of envision somebody. I know all of you are paying attention. You know, you don't want to hear about politics from the pulpit, and that's fine. I don't really like talking about it either. You know that you're supposed to have your primary identity in the kingdom and not affiliated with any particular party. You know that even if there's a politician that you hate, this is still a creation of God, a beloved person of God, and so you don't really even allow yourself to hate political leaders. I know you're all at that level of maturity. That's good. But for this mental exercise, allow yourself to imagine a political figure who you may not like. And I want you to list off a few in your mind, a few words that would describe that person. That person's character, that person's policies, whatever. And I'm going to go to the next slide, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to guess one of those words. Okay, you probably know which words I'm going to guess here. But I'm pretty sure I've covered one of your politicians with these words. Now, I kind of had been doing this exercise with myself, and I thought, you know what? There are some politicians who I think are arrogant, almost beyond redemption, it felt sometimes. And yet, that politician also has supporters who would see that politician as humble, as sympathetic. And yet, those other people, they would see the politician that I sort of admire and say that politician was arrogant or smug. And I thought, well, no, that's not arrogance. And then I started to see part of the problem here. And especially for Mennonite people, we really hold up humility as one of our central virtues. If people are going to sort of compliment your Mennonite legacy, if they say, hey, that Mennonite church that you go to, It's making a difference. That's probably what they're talking about. You've become really peaceful. You've become really humble. Those are the positive legacies. Anyway. So then for us as humble people, people valuing humility, any show of arrogance feels especially sinful. And so then that kind of creates a distance between us and the political figures in our world. But part of it is that we don't want to assert ourselves as though we are better than everybody else. And we don't like it when other people do that to us. But in politics, you sort of have to do that. Right? So right now, we're trying to figure out who's going to be the leader of the Conservative Party. Presumably, the next Prime Minister of Canada, the way that patterns go. Well, who's going to stand up and say, yeah, this job, the most prominent leadership position in the country, I think I'm up for that job. It's going to take a certain amount of arrogance, confidence, pride, some mixture of those three, to assert yourself into that position. This is outside of my personal cultural experience. Yet somehow we still have to do this. The policeman who's approaching the car, no matter who they're talking to, they have to be mentally ready for a conversation involving authority. Any kind of difficult job situation, any kind of difficult parenting situation, any kind of teaching situation, you have to get yourself ready to say, I am in a position to teach, I'm in a position of authority, I get to say something. And so we hate it when the politicians that we hate have arrogance, but we like it when the politicians that we like have arrogance because they have to demonstrate that they belong there. Now, there's good and bad. Confidence is good. Arrogance is bad. So then where does that fit within the psalm? That God rebukes the arrogant, and he rebukes the accursed people who stray from your commandments. So why does God rebuke people if they stray from the commandments? Well, part of it is that the commandments are designed for our collective good. And from time to time, when people get into positions of power, and I think it happens probably 90% of the time, if you ask me, people who find themselves in positions of power allow that power to corrupt themselves so that they no longer feel bound by the laws that the rest of us feel bound by, and no longer feel bound by the expectations that we put on them. So politicians get caught up in corruption all the time because they're surrounded by people who say, yeah, you can do whatever you want. And they participate in a process where millions of us say, yeah, you're fit for the job. And so we still have to read these words with some thoughtfulness, not just for other people, but also for ourselves. God rebukes the arrogant. God rebukes the accursed people who stray from his commandments. So it's easy to sort of cast these rules on other people. But what about ourselves? Are there times where we have participated in patterns of good behavior for so long that we think we don't really need to do this anymore? We think, okay, now finally I'm the parent. I get to behave how I want. And so those old rules don't apply to me anymore. Hey, those rules were important when I was poor, but now I have money. I can do what I want. It's easy for us to put ourselves into positions where we don't think that the rules apply, where the commandments don't apply. When people aren't watching, when there's nobody around us who cares about the rules, then it's easy to set those commandments aside. But the commandments are there for our collective good. Not just for our individual restriction. Jesus gives an example. He tells a story of a feast, and he says, listen, if you're invited to a feast, there's a temptation to walk into that room and to say, ah, I'm important, I get the best seat in the house, I'm going to sit there. But Jesus says, listen, when you do that, the host might come in and say, whoa, 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 I've got that spot reserved for somebody else. You go down, move somewhere else. And then by then, only the humble spots are left. And Jesus says, start in the humble spots. And he's not giving etiquette about attending parties. He's giving etiquette about approaching relationships. Enter relationships with humility. Don't assert yourselves above anybody else publicly. This is a restriction that Jesus is giving his followers, not to make them hate themselves, not to make them on the outside of every social network, but to put yourself in a position where you will earn a higher place at the table. Sit down in a lower place, and the host will come in and say, hey, no, what are you talking about? You're one of my best friends. I can rely on you. I care for you. I trust you. I know that you have helped me in so many situations. You don't belong down there. You belong up here. That's a far better situation to be than for the host to come in and say, yeah, sure. Yeah, that seems to be a good spot. Or worse, whoa, hey, no, I've got somebody better for that spot. We don't attend parties the same way. We don't have assigned seats when we sit down for a meal with other people. But the mentality is the same. You have to assert yourself as a leader in a lot of jobs. You have to assert yourself as a leader of leaders in politics. But in human relationships, when you do that, you're pushing other people down. Jesus' instructions here are to live in the humility of seeing yourself at equal or below other people. Jesus, I think, is continuing the legacy of these psalms of humility. Humility is an important virtue for us. We can take it too far and knock ourselves down to an unhealthy spot. But these words apply for us, that God hates the arrogant. God hates those who think that the rules don't apply to them. The rules do apply to us. They apply to everybody else. So let us, by reflecting on these laws, remember that the rules are there for our collective good. And we are also here for everybody's collective good. So may we rejoice in the comfort that the law provides, and may we rejoice in the comfort that we and our good behavior provide for others. Amen.